It is time to bring in Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. Arthur joins us Monday mornings, and we talk food, food, and food. Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning. I want to talk snow for now because it's very funny. Just as you said, lights, it was fine here. I overcast, and it snowed last night, and there's some gloss on the cars, blah, blah. But just as you said that, it started to snow here.
There you go.
I don't even think it was expected.
Anyway.
So last week, in passing, I mentioned that my six-year-old great-niece, Sydney, makes scrambled eggs exactly the way my grandmother made them. I make them. I taught my nephew to make them, and he has taught his daughter to make them. Now, somebody, Tara Nick, wrote me a note and said, oh, you said this in passing, but you didn't tell us how you make scrambled eggs. So here I am today in the new year with a little cooking lesson. The three of the essential things I think everybody should know how to do: scramble eggs, bake a potato, and roast a chicken. But let's put the word roast in the quote marks, because it's not exactly roasting a chicken, but it's the way I roast a chicken. So I'm going to do these three things, but I have to say to start that somebody said to me the other day, well, my wife doesn't cook, she just prepares meals. And I was like stunned by that comment, because isn't preparing meals cooking? Well, my worst nightmare has come true. I've been saying for 30 years, with the advent, maybe it's 25, with the advent of food television, that everybody was looking to chefs as their model of a cook. And, you know, we can't be chefs at home. But it's not the same thing. It's not like cooking in a restaurant for a lot of people, cooking for you and your loved ones, whoever they may be. So now people say, oh, he doesn't cook, he only prepares meals. And then he went on to say, well, you know, cooking is an art. Preparing meals is something you have to do. Well, you know what? Sometimes you have to do things with a little art. Anyway, here's the scrambled, let's start with the scrambled eggs. They're not the easiest thing. And I must say, this is not the only way to make scrambled eggs. I was talking to a friend the other day, and he swears by a different method, and I only swear by this because it's what the scrambled eggs I grew up eating in my grandmother's house, and I always thought she made the best. Here's what we do. First, you scramble the eggs very, very well. My grandmother used to use an egg beater. I don't think anybody uses an egg beater anymore.
That's right. I used to love those egg beaters with the round.
Yeah, I have one. And in fact, it might, I'm trying to recall, it wasn't my grandmother's, but I have one that's like my grandmother's, and I could never use it because it had a paint. Remember they had the wood at the top?
Yeah.
And painted usually? Yeah. So mine, the paint chips off, so you don't want to use that over a bowl of eggs.
Was your paint
but
red
what
on?
I have to use, and you can use a regular old whisk. You could use a big table fork, which requires a little bit more effort than a whisk, but it works. Or I have something called a Swedish whisk, which a friend gave to me many, many years ago. You can go online and find them. It's a flat whisk. And I say it really works extremely well, especially with eggs. Not everything, but with eggs it's great. So I beat the eggs extremely well, meaning they're very well mixed, even a little bit frothy, with a big pinch of salt. And in the pan should be a no-stick pan, a small no-stick pan. For two eggs, you only need a 6-inch skillet. And I have two, actually, that I use. They're my scrambled egg pans if I'm only making two, maybe three eggs. If I'm making more than three eggs, like for more than one person, I would use an 8-inch pan, 9-inch pan, 8-inch, 9-inch pan. And I have to say, the only thing I swear by for nonstick is eggs. Especially if I'm making something like a frittata or an omelet, a French type omelet. I need a no-stick pan. And a number of years ago, a few years ago, I think I must have mentioned this on the air, I bought one of those coppery looking, but not copper, pans they were advertising on television, on the infomercial. They would put marshmallows in this pan and melt them down and even burn them, and they still wouldn't stick. You know, they were not lying. Nothing sticks to this pan. So these days, I've been using that one, but in any no-stick pan. So you put the pan over medium-high heat, and you melt, depending on how many eggs you're making, a piece of butter. Now, even though it's a no-stick pan, I want the butter for flavor, if nothing else. But that pan that I just mentioned, that copper-looking thing they advertised on TV, actually nothing does stick to that pan, and you don't need to have any butter. A well-worn Teflon, let's say, pan or other non-stick surface pan, they actually do wear down, and a little butter doesn't hurt to make sure that the eggs are not going to stick. But you only need a teaspoon or so of butter per two eggs. If you're making four eggs or five eggs or six eggs, really a tablespoon of butter is more than enough. So as soon as the butter hits the pan, it's going to start melting. And when it is all melted and sizzling, add your eggs. Don't touch them. Just pour in the eggs, scrape the bowl out with the rubber spatula so you get every last drop. And as soon as you see the eggs firming up around the edges, which will be almost immediately, but not quite, reduce the heat to fairly low or low, and push the eggs. Now, I push my eggs with a rubber spatula, a silicone spatula. Silicone doesn't melt in high heat. So a silicone spatula, and in fact, well, I'll get to that in a minute, and you push the eggs from the edge of the pan into the middle of the pan, and immediately, of course, the runny part will rush to the edges, and it will cook. And after you've done this all around the pan at least once, maybe twice, if at this point your heat should be on low, you can start moving from the middle to the edge, because, of course, you've moved all this, pushed all this egg in large, wavy curds into the middle, and now you need to get it out of the middle and get more of the runny egg in the middle. And that's it. When sort of the bottom is almost done, I turn off the heat. By the way, the pan will retain, no matter what pan it is, it'll retain heat for a while and continue cooking the eggs. And I take my spatula and I turn the eggs over so that the wet side can get a little done. I don't like really well-done eggs. If I go to a diner and order eggs, I always say soft scrambled eggs. I never know what I'm going to get. Unlikely I'm going to get what I get at home, but usually they're not, at least they're not well done. And that's it. You put salt and pepper on the table, and that's all you have to do. I think everybody should know how to scramble an egg. Tara Nick, who wrote to me asking me to do this on the air, because I only mentioned it in passing last week, also thought it was quite advanced of my nephew to allow his daughter of 6 years old to make scrambled eggs at the stove. Let me say, she knows how to break eggs into a bowl, and she knows how to beat the eggs. Somebody else has to turn the heat on for her, and she knows how to push it around the pan. So she's not doing it all entirely her six-year-old self. She does it with supervision, and it's safe, you know. And she has. And by the way, because Brian likes his kids to participate in cooking, he's the main cook in the house. He has stools, you know, like a stepladder thing for them to come up so they can get to counter height. I have to laugh about the cracking the eggs because Sydney's very proud of herself that she knows how to break eggs into a bowl. However, one day we had brown eggs, and I have since observed this intentionally. Brown eggs have harder shells than white eggs. At least the brown eggs that I can buy have harder shells than the white eggs I can buy. So whenever we get a brown egg to do, and it took me a little bit of explaining why some eggs are brown and some eggs are white. You know, basically, the color of the chicken is the color of the eggs, but that's not exactly true. Anyway, White chickens do produce white eggs, though. They participate a lot in cooking. So, and her sister's only not even four yet, and she actually likes to do it even more than Sydney. She likes to participate in cooking. And one cute story is what were we making? We were making pancakes. And I said, okay, first we have to measure the ingredients. And the nearly four-year-old says, oh, Uncle Arthur, I'm going to go to my room and get my measure. I didn't know what she was talking about. She comes down with a tape measure. We had to measure the ingredients. So she brought her tape measure to measure the ingredients. Then I had to explain to her cups. And she enjoyed learning all this, by the way. So that's one thing I think everybody should know how to do, scramble eggs. Another one, and you think that everybody could do this, but they don't do it well necessarily, is bake a potato. I have to say, James Beard, I don't know if he wrote this or he said it, it's emblazoned in my soul. When the word gourmet started becoming too popular, like, you know, every corner deli in New York was a gourmet deli, James Beard said, gourmet is not an adjective. It's a noun. And I used to started calling it the G word because it was so ridiculous that everything was gourmet. But the G word, Beard explained, is a gourmet is a person. And a gourmet even appreciates a perfectly baked potato, pointing out that even if you're a gourmet, you appreciate simplicity if it's done well. So here's how I do baked potatoes. And when somebody says, oh, why don't you just throw them in the microwave? I said, you know, it's a different potato. It steams in the microwave. It doesn't bake dry and fluffy. So let's start out with a dry and fluffy potato, which would be a russet potato. That's the variety we call baking potatoes. The best ones really do come from Idaho. Here's a little bit of trivia about potatoes. Potatoes were originally from the Andes in Peru, and they were domesticated by the Mexicans, and hence the potatoes we have today. And potatoes still to this day grow best, most flavorful in high altitudes. So even in Italy, if you go to a mountainous area, they'll say, oh, we have great potatoes here. Even more than the pasta. We have great potatoes here. Idaho, mountainous place, great potatoes. So those are the potatoes you want to use for a baked potato. You scrub the potato. I have a brush that is reserved just for scrubbing vegetables when needed. Potatoes need them more than most. You scrub the potato, make some with the point of a knife, make, I don't know, 5-6 little holes in the potato. This is so that moisture can escape. And then I put it in a cold oven, believe it or not, because I'm lazy and because I never think ahead. So if I want to bake potato for dinner, it takes an hour in a 400-degree oven to bake a medium potato. A large potato could take a little longer. But there's no reason it has to be put into a hot oven. You don't have to preheat. So I just put them in the oven right on the rack, not even on a tray or anything, just right on the rack so that lots of hot air can circulate around the potatoes. And I set the oven to 400 degrees. And even starting in a cold oven at 400 degrees, most potatoes are ready in an hour. How do you know it's ready? I just read this the other day. They said, oh, you shouldn't squeeze a potato to see if it's ready. Well, I never did. What I do is I take a fork or even the knife that I use to puncture the little holes in. If it goes in very easily, the fork, then it's done. Of course, the outer edges of the potato were going to get done quicker than the very middle of the potato. So you do want the fork to be able to go way into the potato very easily, and then you'll know it's done. Then you can pick it up with a potholder and squish it a little bit and see if it's soft. You're going to see the skin, a well-cooked potato, the skin gets a little wrinkly and crisp even, and the inside is going to be very fluffy. Now, here's how you open a potato, And I did learn this from James Beard, perhaps in person. He was a friend. You take your fork and you make a line down the long side of the potato, and then you make a cross with the fork. This is opening up the potato. And then you squeeze the potato. Now, it's going to be very hot, so you may want to do this while you're still holding it in a cloth or a pot holder. And you squeeze the potato, and you open it up like a blossom. And those two lines that are, that cross will open up, and the fluffy potato will emerge. And you put your butter in there, or whatever seasoning you're using. I just like a dab of butter and some salt. And you have a perfect, fluffy, baked potato. A fit for a gourmet, as James Beard would say. I love a good baked potato, and I hate a badly baked potato. And I know in a second, just by looking at it, if it's been cooked in a microwave or not. So that's the second thing I think everybody should know how to do, bake a potato.
The Concord had the best baked potatoes.
They did?
Oh, yeah.
What did they do? No
I
foil, I hope.
What? There was no foil,
they didn't
no.
put them in aluminum foil.
No, no, but they were just the best baked potatoes.
No, I don't wonder what they did. My mother went through a series with baked potatoes, and I remember her period where she... you'll still read recipes like this. You rub it with some fat, like butter or oil, and then you put it in an aluminum, wrap it in aluminum foil, and bake it like that. It's terrible. It comes out steamy, and I don't know.
No.
But it's not fit for a gourmet, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I remember.
By the way, those potatoes are very useful potatoes for other things, but they are really the perfect potato for baked potatoes. You can't bake a Yukon Gold and get the same result.
No. The skin,
you'll get a nice potato, but no, it's not going to be like a fluffy grape. I mean, you could put sour cream on a baked potato. I mean, people put a lot of different things on a baked potato. In fact, wasn't there a restaurant? I think there was a restaurant that specialized in baked potatoes with all kinds of toppings.
I think they're out of business now.
I think they are, too. Yeah, well, then everybody became carb-phobic, so that was the end of a baked potato restaurant. There was a period there where we thought that was a healthy thing to eat, a baked potato topped with chili or something like that. Or I love these twice-baked potatoes. That means you bake the potato, and then you fluff it out with some extraordinary fatty ingredients, and then put them back in the potato. So the third thing, I think, this is just this week. We're going to do this, I think, let's just say the beginning of every month we'll do a little thing like this, a little cooking class. And thank you, by the way, Tara Nick, for suggesting I do the scrambled eggs. And then we've got a roast chicken. Now, you know, they always say, oh, that's the test of a great chef and so hard to do and perfection and people paying a lot of money these days for a roast chicken in a restaurant. I don't know. I, years ago, started not roasting a whole chicken, but roasting a butterfly chicken, spatchcocked, they're called. I mean, I have to look up that word. I don't know what the derivation of the word is. I like to say a butterfly chicken. And how I do that, now, I do whole chickens this way, and I do chicken parts this way, although my parts are thighs, my favorite part, our favorite part. So I most often just cook thighs. Excuse me. But sometimes I do a whole chicken. And for dinner, we'll just eat the thigh leg joints. And I'll save the breasts for the next day to make chicken salad or some other dish that requires cooked chicken, and you have these nice juicy breasts if you cook it the way I tell you. So I do all kinds of different seasonings, but truly salt and pepper is my go-to. Let's do the spatchcock first, and then we can do the thighs. The spatchcock, I use my very, very sharp and efficient Joyce Chen scissors for this. They cut through chicken bone. But a poultry shears or a strong other kind of scissors that will cut through chicken bones is needed. You can use a knife to do this too, but it's a little, you need a little skill for that, and I just prefer the scissors. It's so easy. You cut out the backbone, which is, I don't know, you, what do you call the little tushy of the chicken? It, sometimes it's called the Pope's nose. I think that's probably blasphemous.
But, it is, but that's what my grandmother used to call it.
I think we have a Pope now who doesn't have a nose. We can call it Pope's nose, Pope Francis. Anyway, the backbone goes from the Pope's nose to the other end of the chicken, and you just go along in a straight line, and you will have cut out the backbone of the chicken. And I don't throw that away. I roast that along with the rest of the chicken because that's the chef's share. So on the underside of the chicken, you salt and pepper it very well. On the skin side, you salt and pepper it very well, and you put it on a baking sheet. Press it down a little bit if you haven't cracked some of the bones, you'll easily crack them by just pressing it down on the sheet so it lays relatively flat. The legs should be splayed out. If there's any extra, you could take off extra fat, but if there's extra skin, leave it on and do spread it out on the pan because I love how it gets really, really crisp as the chicken roasts. And I put my chicken into a preheated, this time, 450-degree oven. Did I say salt and pepper the top side? And then also, I brush the skin with olive oil. Just, you only need a tablespoon or so for the whole chicken. And this aids in the crisping of the chicken. Put it in a 450-degree oven for 40 to 45 minutes. Now, depends on the size of the chicken. I've been reading and actually cooking from my first cookbook, Cooking in a Small Kitchen, which was republished after 40 years. I'm very proud of that. Last year, it's available on Amazon. It is a photo reproduction of the original book from 40 years ago. Nothing was changed, and some things should have been changed, but I wasn't allowed to change them. I made something the other day that I realized I should have changed this. I'll get to that in a sec. Anyway, I put it in the oven for... I was about to say, in that book, chickens were still 2.5 pounds. But nowadays, it's hard to find a 2.5-pound chicken. Most chickens are a minimum of 3 pounds, if not 3.5 pounds, or even closer to 4 pounds. Now, if you have a 4-pound chicken, you can cook it this way, but of course it's going to need more time than a 3-pound chicken. So, depends on your chicken, 40 to 45 minutes, certainly if it's a big chicken, maybe 50 minutes, but no more than that. And the skin will get really brown and crisp in 50 minutes. But even in 40 minutes, it's beautifully colored and crisp. And that's it. Now, the other day I made chicken, and I decided to do my grandmother's seasoning, which wasn't salt and pepper, but salt and paprika. And I have to say, it was really, really good. And in my Jewish book, there's actually a recipe, like my grandmother would do it, where she would make a paste of crushed garlic and paprika and a little bit of oil and rub that all over the chicken. That's really good.
Yeah, paprika gives a nice color.
But paprika, I must say, adds a lot to a chicken. And by the way, if you have paprika that's more than a year old, throw it away, get some fresh paprika. Paprika doesn't last that long. And I remember last year, 2 years ago maybe, Sam Sifton, the food editor of the New York Times, and I were discussing making chicken paprikash, and in the end, his story that ran in the Times Magazine pointed out that if you have some paprika on your shelf, you probably should throw it away and start fresh because you really need a fresh, fruity-flavored paprika to make chicken paprikash. So that's it. That's roast chicken. Now, if you only do thighs the way I do, you only need 40 minutes at 450 degrees. But do remember to season the non-skin side of the chicken before you put it in the oven. It really makes a difference to put a heavy seasoning on the on the fleshy side of the chicken, even if it's just the chicken thighs. And then on top, too. And I put a nice coating of paprika. I wasn't stingy with the paprika. I'm trying to use this paprika up, actually, which is why I decided to do this. Here's one that I almost did the other day, but I'm reserving it. This is a recipe that's in my book, The Southern Italian Table, and it's something that I picked up in the food markets of Catania, the food market of Catania. It's called La Pescheria, but in fact, it's a lot. Pesca is fish, but it's a lot more than fish. Although when you first walk down into the market, it's the fish area. But if you keep walking, it's blocks and blocks of food stalls. And there's different sections, a dairy section, a pig section, a prepared meat section. And in the prepared meat section, I saw this. I went home and cooked it, and it's become one of my standard things. Still at 450 degrees, 400 for 40 minutes, you take a leg-thigh joint, the whole leg-thigh joint, and you slash, they say three slashes, maybe two in the thigh and one on the leg with a knife, and go relatively deep. And inside each one of those slashes, you season it with hot paprika. Oh, if you like sweet paprika, you can use that too. But in Sicily, they use paprika in Sicily because they have a lot of peppers, after all. And what is paprika but dried, powdered pepper, sweet pepper or hot pepper? So, and in Calabria, they use a lot of paprika, hot paprika, because they love hot pepper. So you sprinkle the slits with the paprika, and a lot of it's going to, or some of it anyway, is going to get onto the skin too, but you only have to, and season them with salt. And then in each slit, put a small sprig of rosemary. Really get it into that slit. And then put the chicken in the oven, again, 40 minutes, 450 degrees, and it is delicious. Between the hot paprika and the rosemary, which doesn't really, depends on the rosemary, truly. I have some in the house right now that is extremely strong. So the first time I made it, it was a little overpowering, but I used it. But the second time I used it, I knew better. So you have to know your ingredients. And that's it. It's really delicious. It's so simple, too. So there's my cooking lesson for today.
And I just roasted a chicken this weekend.
You did, but do you do it whole or butterfly?
I did one whole, and I was roasting that because I was going to make chicken soup, and I did. And I took a 4-pound chicken, cut it in half, like you just did, and I put a little bit of barbecue sauce in it and on it, and roasted that.
Well, delicious. But what do you mean you cut it in half? Like I butterfly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you
go right down the butterfly. Butterfly. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I actually recently did this teriyaki style. Bob is from Hawaii. He grew up in he was born in Iowa, but when he was a year old, they moved to Hawaii, and he stayed there until he was 20 something, until he finished graduate school, and he never left the island until he was 23. So he's addicted to teriyaki, which they don't call teriyaki in Hawaii. They just call it barbecue, but it's teriyaki. Usually made on a barbecue over coal, you know, grilled over coal,
yeah.
Which I don't have in Brooklyn, right. But my friends do sometimes. But anyway, it was. It's actually I can't rattle off. I've tried so many different teriyaki sauces, but this, I think, is the one I'm going to stick with for a while. It's called, if you look up online, it's called Huli Huli Chicken. H-U-L-I, Huli, H-U-L-I, like hula hula, but this is Huli Huli. And Bob says it's a huli is a step in the hula, where you've seen hula dancers, and they do a turn at some point. You know, they do like a 360-degree turn. That's a huli.
Okay.
Well, in this case, the huli huli means turn. It does mean turn, turn. And the reason it's turn, turn is that when you make teriyaki, and even your barbecue sauce, I would think, because it has sugar in it, tends to burn quickly.
Yes.
So you have to keep turning the chicken so that it it becomes a glaze and it becomes a great flavor, but it doesn't burn. So you every time it's you think you know every few minutes you've got to turn the chicken, huli huli. So if you look it up online, you'll find huli huli chicken. It may be a recipe that ran in the New York Times and is on their cooking website. It could be. I don't recall. Next time I want to make it, I'm just going to go on, like I just told you to, and look up huli huli. I don't think there are too many teriyaki recipes called huli huli chicken.
All right.
The surprising ingredient in that particular teriyaki sauce was ketchup. But in the end, it doesn't taste like ketchup at all. My feeling about it is that it possibly was hoisin sauce originally. And in a lot of Chinese-American recipes, or certainly in Hawaii, which is a very cross-cultural place, never saw so many biracial families or triracial families as in Hawaii. Ketchup is often a substitute for hoisin sauce. So it would taste more Chinese, probably, if you used hoisin instead of ketchup. But you wouldn't know in the end that this teriyaki sauce was based on ketchup. Soy sauce, of course.
All right. That's the cooking lesson for
so
today.
Everybody have a great New Year. I think we haven't talked since New Year. And enjoy the snow.
All right. We'll speak to you next week, Arthur.
Take care.
Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, here on Robin Hood Radio, robinhoodradio.com.
Underwriting support for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, John Andrews Restaurant on the Hillsdale Road in South Egremont, 413-528-3467. On the web, jarestaurant.com. Rubiner's Cheesemongers and Grocers on Main Street in Great Barrington, 413-528-0488, rubiners.com. Hillsdale Home Chef, more information, 518-325-7000, hgshomechef.com.